One for $9.99.
I'm sorry, miss. Tickets are $10. Which movie?
$9.99. That's the movie's title, you limp cretin. One, please, and pronto. My bladder's about to burst. All that Diet Coke. Wait a minute. I know that voice.
We don't have a movie named One here. Which movie?
That? Is that you?
That isn't playing here either. Which movie?
Come off your Abbott and Costello high horse. Why are you working here?
You have me confused with someone else.
Bass, are you drunk?
Ah, you mean $9.99. It runs 78 minutes.
78 minutes? That isn't long enough for a movie. Sounds like you're trying to gyp me. Where's my alimony?
Well, you can always take it up with Ali the manager. He'll give you money.
Okay, so I'm here with Tatya Rosenthal, who is most recently the writer, co-writer, and director behind $9.99. Tatya, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
First off, I must point out that this film, in two specific instances, essentially does away with the maxim, good things come in threes. I'm wondering if this was a conscious decision upon your part, that this was just inherently in the stories, inherently in the interconnected nature of the stories, and also about the notion of maxims in general, with which I think this film usurps and overturns a considerable number of them.
Before I answer that, I'm really curious about the number three that you're talking about. Where do you see
I see the three and
away.
The three little guys, the furniture development that we see near the end. So that's why I have to ask.
Interesting. I never thought of it. You're right. I think it takes three to make a rule or to get a good dialogue going. I think, you know, things that come in twos are very, you know, are a bit closed off or more relationship-oriented versus a group. And since it's such a low-budget film, the cheapest number is three if you're going to go for anything over two.
Yes, but you shot this one particular movement every two frames and not every three frames. I'm very curious about that. Why did you settle on the two frames? Was that the minimum amount of frames that you could use to get the kind of look of this film right? Because I know some animators have to go as far as six or seven frames. Like Bill Plimpton, for example.
Oh, right. That's a very... I don't think that style really would work for puppets. I think that kind of humming of pictures that really works well for Bill. I think, you know, he incorporates it amazingly well and his line vibrates and all that. I think for stop motion, the big argument is, are you going ones or are you going twos? And Henry Selick will always go ones and Corpse Bride and... Coraline, and then the Aardman films are done on twos, and I think they're as exquisite. So again, for our budget, twos was the way to go, but I actually really like that aesthetic.
Yeah, you like two more than one then, because you need to have a fixed motion. The eye doesn't necessarily going to discern the difference between one and two, or at least the audience's eye. I mean, is there really that much of a difference for you?
Oh, I have animators friends who would, you know, fight you to the death by claiming that they can see the difference between ones and twos. I think some people will see it, some won't, and I find it actually extra smooth, and it has to, it's beautiful, but it has to really work with your aesthetic. And I think for us, we needed a little more, you know, handmadeness, gruffness to go with the painting style of the puppets, the animation style of the puppets, etc.
Sure. There's one thing I wanted to ask you, and that struck me about $9.99, which I'll refer to as $9.99 for shorthand. The characters' proportions in relation to their environments is very interesting, because they're just either a smidgen wider or a smidgen bigger, and it's just minute enough for you to notice, but also to be lost within the sense of scale. And I wanted to ask how this particular scale developed, because I found this to be very essential with the manner in which the films unfold. So you're dealing with something that is essentially realist to some degree, but at the same time, there's this larger than life, just slightly larger than life quality within this scale question. So how did this develop?
I think what you're referring to probably would be the hands of the puppets, which is a 1/5 scale versus the bodies of the puppets that are 1/6 scale.
Aha.
Which is, I think, what's giving you that impression. And also the idea that when they were sculpted, we were, I mean, they're quite anatomically right, I would say, to people. But I just wanted to give it that extra, you know, impressionistic touch.
Yeah.
So we were not that rigid with that.
I also ask about the camera placement. It's often placed low or roughly below chest level. So you get this, this could also lead to this scale proportion that I'm observing in the work as well. I mean, why did this camera placement come to be? Was it a way of just making these small figures larger or even, you know, slightly out of proportion with the reality that's depicted in your film or what?
You're probably referring to our the DPs, Susan Stitt, James Lewis, and Richard Bradshaw affinity to... And myself, actually, affinity to short lenses that, you know, skew the proportion. What's closer to the lens is way bigger, etc. I think it just felt very right for the aesthetic of the film and the shallow depth of field and the lighting. We wanted to be a bit magical and off-kilter, same way the puppets were in the sets to an extent, but we didn't really push that very far.
Well, on the subject of the lighting, I should point out the angel in particular is often immersed in shadow. Was this a situation in which you wanted to disguise some of the features of the puppets so that they would appear more mysterious? Or was it a case where you perhaps had some characters who you needed to throw a lot of paint down on to get that texture and others in which it worked best if they were kind of immersed in the shadows? How did this work out?
I think we mostly did not shoot the puppets to serve their textures, but we really went for what serves the frame, like we were shooting real film. Mm-hmm. And I think lighting was determined to create mood more than anything else.
Well, the other thing I wanted to note is sweat in this film and bodily fluids in general. Now, we see sweat in a love scene late in the film and also in the elevator. However, going back to this question of lighting, I should point out that you lit this in such a way so it appears that the texture is sweating even though it isn't. So I'm wondering how you dealt with this idea of actually having to put some sort of moisture on the puppets in order to get that sense of sweat. And not only that, but you also have to animate this as well. So I'm curious how this came about.
I think you're going to be surprised with the answer. Did you like it?
Yeah, I did.
Interesting, because it was an accident, and we were doing our best to conceal the sweaty look, because the silicone actually appears shiny and looks like sweat, the material that we used, and we were doing our damnedest to erase it with powders and stuff like that, and then some of it would get revealed because the animators were touching the puppets, and they looked like they gradually were sweating, and then when we got to post, what we did is, where it was really distracting, we deleted it frame by frame,
really?
Painstakingly. And the places where it stayed is the places where it felt appropriate to the scene, like you're remarking.
Yeah.
So it was really a sweating in reverse.
Oh, but I like sweat. Characters should sweat. Puppets should sweat.
I like it now.
Yeah, exactly. Also, I want to ask you, likewise, about animating smoke, fire, and water. Fire largely in relation to the cigarettes and the like. What did you use for this to animate it? I also should point out that in your short film, A Buck's Worth, which was essentially the template for this movie, the cigarette smoking in that has all this smoke going into the air, and yet in this film we see very little smoke. And I find that, except for the smoke ring that, of course, the angel lets loose in the elevator. Why was the smoke cut down upon when you went to feature? And also, maybe you can get into the idea of animating the natural elements like this.
All our natural elements were done in computer,
okay,
with very rare exceptions. This is for budgetary reasons. I think to have used our art department's resources to animate something that is essentially a spice rather than, you know, the meat of the film, was going to be a huge sacrifice of their time and talent. And we actually had to cut a few sets from the script, so we, you know, it was tight enough that there was no way of doing that. And then when we got to post, it was the same issue. We had our resources, and we had to decide what was important. And smoke, by the time we got to it, we realized it wasn't that important anymore.
Hmm.
That people who were watching the film without it bought it, and we only used it in places where it had to be part of the narrative, like the ring smoke that you talk about. And then we put all our energy into water and fire.
I'll get back to this notion of removing the smoke in one moment, but I do want to ask you about this question of compositing. Do you feel, I mean, first of all, I want to find out how much compositing you did for this. You have a stop-motion animation. It's a fairly pure format. So to what degree were you willing to interfere through post-compositing, and to what degree were you able to keep it the same? Did you set down any kind of hard, religious We must stick to stop motion animation throughout most of this. What rules, the ground rules in terms of when you decided to interfere and when you didn't?
I think the guiding rule was what would serve the film better. I'm not a purist by any way, and I think each shot was determined of what's the value I'm going to get with my budget using people now or using people later, you know, post or now. And also, let's say the three little pigeons that you mentioned, there was no way for us to shoot that with the large puppet and a small puppet in the same frame for real. So the best thing to do was to shoot regular size puppet and then shrink them down in post for Lilliputians.
Yeah.
I remember one example, we had I was pushed to, you remember the turntable scene where
yes.
to have three puppets spinning on top of a record meant we needed a really large record. And I was pushed to not make the large element for that. And yet I felt that if we were to composite our puppets onto a small turntable and try to match the spinning and the perspective on that, that would not look good. So this was an example where I pushed to do things in camera.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, I mean, in terms of this notion of scale, this actually makes me curious. I mean, is it a situation like this record scenario in which you have to resize things? Or was it your motivation when making this film to try to keep things within the scale that you decided in the initial stages, relatively within those particular parameters?
Again, you try to do everything as simply as you can. We knew we had Lilliputians. We knew that the elements with which they interact very physically would have to be made on a very large scale.
I want to ask about the piggy bank, who has a very specific look that is interesting in light of the fact that the human characters have mouths that really kind of do this O thing, but never really quite broaden throughout the ends of their cheeks. So you have, with the piggy bank, almost a character in and of itself. And I want to ask about how the look for both the O's of the humans and the considerable broad smile of the piggy bank came about, and how much of this was a conscious relationship between the two.
I think it's a truism for a stop motion animator that when you decide to have dialogue for your film, you're going to have to come up with a good mouth replacement system or a face replacement system or what have you to have your characters speak. And I think that's the reason why so many short films opt to tell a story without any dialogue, because on some level, unless you have an unlimited budget, it compromises the aesthetic of your puppets if their mouths are going to have to be replaced so they can have the dialogue. So the piggy is a non-speaking character, and therefore he has this fully realized designed smile that gives him a full expression.
Yeah.
And the people, since they had to speak, we came up again with the best system we could to have them express themselves and for us to be able to finish the film. So,
You were writing the script, you were thinking in terms of lines of dialogue as to how much time that would take to animate the mouths. This was a consideration of the budgeting and the preparation for this?
It's definitely a consideration with the length of the film, I would say.
Okay.
I mean, the dialogue is the dialogue that we needed. I think me and Edgar Keret, the writer, never ever thought of cutting lines just for, you know,
sure,
for the sake of cheapening the film. We wanted to make the best film that we could.
Okay. Well, I also want to get into this irksome debate that often goes around in animation circles. The idea that animation has to have some sort of fantastical element to it in order to be truly considered animation. Here is a film that is predominantly real, quote real. I had mentioned the proportions, so maybe there's room for debate for these sort of hard fantasists. But it does have a lot of magical realist elements, such as the angel who is fluttering his wings, the three Lilliputians who we had mentioned earlier. And I'm wondering, did these magical realist elements, was this a way for you, I suppose, to deflect such criticisms, or were they essentially there in the original source material and you needed to go ahead and... I'm just curious about your thoughts on this rather controversial subject at times.
I myself am not a supporter of the claim that you have to have a wacky, magical, can't do it any other way element in the film in order for it to be animated at all. I think the real question one should ask oneself when coming to make a film is, can I tell this story well in animation? And that's it. Does animation serve my story? Can I get across a certain mood? What is my tone? Do I know how to make it in animation? That's it. I don't think the medium should serve an element. I think the medium should serve a story, and if you can tell it well and you feel you can tell it well, then by all means do it. And therefore, again, we did not cater the script because we felt like making an animated film. We really felt that an animated film would be the best medium to tell Edgar Keret's stories.
Yeah, but nevertheless, the hardcore fantasists are going to come at you and say, well, wait a minute, this could have been shot in a realist mode or using regular photography. I mean, the problem we have here is that animation is unfortunately considered something that is either kiddie or Pixar or something that is fantastical. Is there any particular cure that you find for this? Any kind of panacea for this regrettable perception, particularly here in the States?
Well, I hope it's changing, and I think it's changing. Yeah. I mean, Persepolis, Waltz with Bashir, phenomenal films that were telling personal, very dramatic stories with animation and did it incredibly well. And I think the more of those kind of film are out there, the more the expectation of a very limited range of stories animation can tell will change.
Sure. Let's talk about the eyes, because I think that this is one thing I never really get to talk to when I talk with animators. And there is an interesting scenario in which you have, for example, with the lonely old widower, he has these considerable wrinkles behind his eyes. And yet I was struck in looking at your film again, was the notion of blinking and how the blinking ratio works in sustaining the illusion that these characters are alive. What are your thoughts on blinking? And I'll get into other facial mannerisms soon, but I'm curious. It seems to me that eyes are, of course, being the window of the soul, have to have that sense of sustaining an illusion. So what are your thoughts on this, and what do you do to get the eyes like this?
Well, absolutely. I think when working with the animators, one of our main concern was how do we break away from stereotypical body motions that are telegraphing emotion, like, you know, a big, like putting your hand on your forehead to say you're sad, or, you know, waving your arms on the sides to say you're happy. I mean, some cliches, very iconic. There's an instinct sometimes, since animation is from kids, to have that kind of exaggerated reality. And I think we wanted to get as far away from that as possible. And for me, good acting has a lot to do with what your eyes do in life. And I think that was a very important thing to transfer to animation.
Yeah. Movement in this. I'm curious if you observed other people to get the particular gestures and the movement right, and to what degree the movement sort of announced itself during the animation process, that it became something that was more organic rather than a sort of replication of how humans walk and how humans pick up a teacup and the like.
It's a very, very personal decision for each animator who was working on the film, of which we had 10 animators. I think a lot would like to do the action themselves, walk around the room, jump on the table, and, you know, try to get it to a phone, and would try to feel in their body what it feels like and then break it down to the timing of the action. And sometimes not. It really depends on the needs of the shot.
Sure. I also want to ask you about the show and tell scene, which has the most characters out of all the scenes, and what you did to plan this sense of constant movement. First of all, there were a lot of pigtails in that scene, and that's what was very interesting to me. And I said to myself, yeah, are these kinds of ways to deflect what's going on before? But also this goes back to this other question about how often you need to have a character move in order to know that that character is alive. In a scenario like the show and tell scene, there's a lot of characters. So what is really the balance of the right level of movement before it either becomes too spastic or perhaps too dead?
I think it has to do with what else is going on in the scene at any given moment. Obviously, the richer the scene is, the more you can get away with some of the characters not moving as often. And as you mentioned, this is probably the scene with the most characters in the film. But I have to say, to get that one done, we brought in a heavy hitter, Anthony Elworthy, who worked with Henry Selick on Corpse Bride and then on Coraline. He came in on his way to Coraline and knocked the scene out incredibly quickly, and I was very grateful to have him.
How ambitious can you be on such a limited budget? I mean, we have this show and tell scene, but there's also a couple of tracking shots, such as the shot of the repo van and the camera dollies along. And so this leads me to wonder what challenges you had in executing a number of technical shots along these lines. That were there moments during the production of this film where you had to cut corners and kind of scale down your initial ambitions? What happened here?
I knew from the onset that trying to make a stop-motion feature for the budget we had was incredibly challenging. So I was not very ambitious in the planning. I think the mere fact that we made the film was the big ambition.
Yeah.
And to have it be emotional and nice to look at and all those things. So I think as far as specific shots go, we only had in there what we absolutely had to have. And the bigger ambition was really to get those characters to be touching.
I also wanted to ask about the color coordination, which I think is seen most prominently in the penultimate scene involving the piggy bank with the dad having this almost dirtied pink shirt as this pink piggy bank is about to face some kind of fate. And I'm curious to what level, what motivated color coordination more than other scenes? Because some scenes you have characters who are wearing fairly typical clothes that we would expect them. And then in this scene we see almost kind of a sullied pink, which represents almost like kind of a sullied pink virtue of the piggy bank. So when did you need to push the color coordination along this thematic scope and when did you not?
I think the question of color coordination had to do a lot with the genius of Melinda Doering, the production designer. I think we picked colors what felt instinctively right for the character. I think in the case of the dad, it's almost coincidental that he's wearing that color, yet not. I think it does create the effect you talk about because we wanted a really sort of a straight-laced dad, but then he has ambitions. He wants to be a really cool dad, but he's not. So he wants to be a really cool guy, so he has a pink shirt, but he's not a really cool guy. So I think if you have the pig representing all these beautiful, you know, magical things, and you have a guy who thinks of himself, you know, as somebody really full of imagination and, you know, that he can connect to his kid, but he's not. So I think that's how you got those two colors together.
Well, the meaning of life, have you had any personal involvement with the self-help movement? Did you unfortunately read Dale Carnegie at some point along the way? Or was this something that came from the story?
This came from the story.
Okay.
This is from Edgar's original story by the name. For 1999, Israeli shekels, not including VAT.
Yeah. But nevertheless, the look of these particular books is far more graphical than what is normally seen with these particular books. So there is the decision, I suppose, on your part.
Yes.
How did that come about? Why a more sort of graphical, almost bizarrely photoshopped InDesign kind of scenario for the inside of the book? I mean, that's probably the slickest self-help book I think I've seen, you know?
We were having a little bit of fun with the graphic department, which was one person. Jane Chadbald and I were trying to find the most sort of ironic looking ads for those books and wanted to make a very tangible visual for what it is that they were trying to sell, I guess in irony.
Well, Tatya, thanks so much. It was a pleasure chatting with you. It was a good time.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.